This interview is taking place today, Tuesday, 6th of December, at the Norman Lindsay Gallery in Springwood. I would like to acknowledge that this interview is taking place on the country of the Darug people, and I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you.
Now, if we can start with your very early years. You were born in 1948. Your mother, Margaret Cohen, was an artist best known for her watercolours. Your father, Douglas Stewart, was a poet, writer, and editor from New Zealand. You are a filmmaker and writer, so there's a lot of artistic genes in there. Can you tell me a bit about your parents and the kind of people they were?
Well, of course, I thought they were just normal people. Sometimes people have said to me, what was it like having a mother who was an artist and a father who was a poet? To be truthful, I just thought that's the way the world was. I knew other people did do different things, but it didn't seem extraordinary to me. And I always thought that poetry and art and writing were really, and music as well, but not so much because they weren't musicians, were really the things that made the world go round. So they seemed quite normal to me, really, as a small child. Looking back at it now, I think one of the great things they gave me was a belief in the power of the imagination, because that was another thing about them. It really coloured our whole life back then, I think, imagination and the power of creativity was sort of taken for granted, which is an enormous blessing to be given that as a child. My mother was quite extraordinary because she did stop painting for a little bit after I was born, but she still kept drawing. And she said during the early days when she used to take me out as a baby for walks around Circular Quay or on the ferry, she taught herself to draw by memory so that she would memorise a scene and then go home and draw it that night when she got back. She didn't do a lot of painting in those years. I was five when I first went to school, but as soon as I was at school, she was back painting again. I always knew she was an artist. Both Norman and my father always referred to her as an artist. I had no sense of her being inferior or not an artist, or that her role might have been to cook and clean the house, which she did, but it was never seen as that was her primary role in the house. And of course, the fact that Dad wrote poetry, I also took for granted. And there was always an excitement in the house. He wouldn't show you works when they were in progress. But later on, when the poem was finished, he'd produce it and we were allowed to read it. And that was always an exciting moment. That was not so much when I was a very little girl, but when I was able, from about the age of 7 or 8, that became sort of part of the ritual of our life together.
So you say I was going to ask you what values they did impart to you. You've mentioned imagination as important.
I suppose the sense for me personally that art was really important, that literature was really important. Personally, I thought that I could do anything, not in a very grand sense. I didn't plan to be a general or anything, but I never questioned the fact that I would have a career. I always thought that I would have a career and that would be a natural thing to do. I felt very comfortable around people painting. I knew that when either Mum was painting or Dad was writing, that was a time when they weren't to be interrupted. You had to respect that creative process, and they were very careful. Mum didn't like to be, you couldn't go and talk to Mum when she was painting, she hated it. You could bring her a cup of tea at an appropriate hour. And she often worked at St. Ives within the actual, her studio wasn't separated from the rest of the house. So we could see her working. She didn't like people looking at her, and she certainly didn't want us around. And Dad would lock himself in a room to write. Whether it was when we first moved to St. Ives, he would lock himself in the bedroom and write there. I think when we lived in the studio at 12 Bridge Street, there was even less space, and he did a lot of his creative writing actually in the offices of the Bulletin, which were just around the corner from us in George Street in those days.
Is that why he came to Australia from New Zealand for that job?
Yes. In fact, he came to Sydney once a couple of years before, and he thought he was going to get a job on the Bulletin, and he stayed here for a couple of months, but that job never eventuated, so he went back. Then he left New Zealand and went to England, in fact, following a girl, not my mother, but another woman he was in love with called Daphne, and they travelled around England together. We always had a joke about how he lived in a packing case in London, but I don't think it actually was a packing case at all. And then Daphne came back to New Zealand, and I think really he wanted to come back to New Zealand to be with Daphne. However, he wrote to the Bulletin and asked if he could be the New Zealand correspondent for the Bulletin, and the Cecil man from the Bulletin replied that he should stop off in Sydney and see him about this. So he stopped off in Sydney, and they offered him a job, and he stayed. Mm-hmm. A year later, the engagement with Daphne was broken off, and then he met my mother, and he stayed on, and quite soon was the literary editor of the Bulletin. Mm. So it was he'd always knew about the Bulletin. He always wanted to work on the Bulletin, but he did have a love life in New Zealand at that time, so he would have been in great conflict if that relationship had continued, which it didn't.
Yes. How did your parents meet?
They seemed a little unsure about how they met in later years. I think the story is, every Christmas my mother used to have a punch party at the studio at 12 Bridge Street, which she had then taken in the 1940s. She took that over from Norman as her own studio, and she would hold a punch party there with this in a punch bowl and goblets that she bought from Leo Buring's, that she fell in love with the look of it and paid it off on a lay-by. And someone brought Dad to one of her punch parties, he thinks, just before he was about to go back to New Zealand to marry Daphne. He went back to New Zealand, Daphne broke the engagement off, he came back to Australia heartbroken, and as Mum said, almost the moment he was back in Sydney, landed on her doorstep. So he was sort of, I don't know whether the romance blossomed straight away, but he certainly was seeking consolation for a broken heart. Mm. And it seemed to be, Mum must have made an impression on him at the party, because he didn't seem to hesitate about what he wanted to do after that.
I mean, how did your mother come to know Norman?
Well, Mum, I think, had known about Norman all her life, almost. My mother was terribly determined to be an artist, almost from when she was a small girl growing up in Yass. So she was always fixated about being an artist. She went to school at King Koppel Convent at Elizabeth Bay, where she was very lucky to have Antonio de Tillo Rubo as her art teacher. So, and the nuns recognised her talent, and actually when the family couldn't afford them anymore, they paid for her art lessons to continue. And there's a book that's now in the State Library of New South Wales as a project in her final year. She did a sort of art history book, and she wrote a chapter, or a few pages about Norman. She also had a cousin called John Richard Flanagan, who was a black and white artist who worked briefly with Norman at the Bulletin. So she had this notion of Norman being someone high up in the art world that she respected. And then after she left school and was working as a commercial artist, another commercial artist brought her and a woman friend up here to visit Norman and Rose. Now, she would have been, I don't know, about 20 then.
Right.
And quite what happened then, but she obviously made quite an impression on Norman, and Norman made quite an impression on her. Whether they began an affair then, or they just sort of flirted, or maybe didn't even outwardly flirt, but something seems to have happened even at that first visit. And then there was another visit up here as a group when they all went to a dance, I think. Norman and Rose then went overseas for a period. This is still in the 1930s. Then they came back, and then my mother and Norman seemed to become more closely romantically involved in any... Mm. But as far as we can tell, they had an affair in the 1930s, which then seemed to peter out or became a really abiding friendship.
Yes.
And Mum really mothered Norman in a way. She was a sort of combination of a mother, an artist's assistant, and lover, but it was very much a relationship of affection.
Yes.
However, so there's this strong involvement between Mum and Norman. And then Dad had also, when he came to Australia in the end of the 1930s, because he was working at the Bulletin, was introduced to Norman by the poet Mackenzie. So Dad met Norman independently. So they both had this sort of and friendship with Norman happening, so that when they became involved, it was logical that Norman was a part. It was a friendship between the three of them, really. I hope that's explained it. That's about as much as I can explain. They both had a connection to Norman. Dad was terribly admiring of Norman. He had actually written to Norman. I found a letter many years after he died, which was written to Norman from New Zealand, asking if he'd consider illustrating a poem that Dad had written. So Norman was a sort of hero of Dad's. And Mum, and I suppose that increased Mum's attractiveness in his eyes, because not only was she this beautiful, talented artist, slightly older woman, she also was someone who was very close to Norman, who was Dad's sort of hero in a way. So that would have only added to her appeal in my father's eyes, I guess. Whether he knew that Mum had been Norman's mistress, I'll never know the answer to that. And I think if he did know, he probably managed to blot it out of his mind, as that generation were quite good to do. There was certainly never any awkwardness between my parents and Norman. You never sensed any sense of tension between the three of them.
And sadly, your father died not long before it was published and you dedicated it to him. What was his input into the book, and what was his input into your sort of writing more generally?
Oh, well, he was terribly supportive, even as a child, of all my sort of homework. He always read every essay that I did and loved them, like English composition. They weren't called essays, they're called compositions. And when I was in high school, he helped me with my Latin homework every night with my translation and with my history sort of project. So he always encouraged my writing. But I don't think either of us thought necessarily I was going to be a writer. They were very thrilled when I did anything creative. They actually came along and were extras in the film in one scene of Last Breakfast in Paradise. They're in a car in a traffic jam. I realised I was writing in quite a public way, but I really only had to be myself, and that people really wanted to hear my voice. And the big thing was to learn to actually write without input from anyone, and that people actually wanted to know, because it was always quite personal writing, what you were doing yourself.
The first edition of your book, and we'll talk about this again a bit later, but you say that you hadn't at that stage read the letters between your mother and Norman Lindsay.
That's right, not when, because Autobiography of My Mother was, I think, published at the end of 1985, and it would have been written in perhaps 1983, and I certainly hadn't read them then.
They were in your mother's possession,
were they? They were in my mother's possession, yes, but I hadn't read them because I wouldn't write Autobiography of My Mother now. It was very much a sort of a Zen book, and I think it's an innocent book. You know, I just went in and I relied on her. I didn't double check things particularly. I had no notion. I was much more interested in the flavour of a person telling a story in their own voice, of the stories being recounted, all these stories I'd heard from my childhood. I knew she was reliable and accurate. I didn't doubt that. In the second edition, when it came out again much later, I did double check and change just a few things that she, or elaborate on a few points. But it never occurred to me, she didn't say you should read these letters. She was very she told the story of her and Norman as she thought it should be told then, which didn't include any description of a love affair between them. So, again, whether she had decided that... I don't really quite know what she was decided, because she didn't want my father to know, or she didn't want her family to know, or she just thought it was better for all concerned that it didn't come out. It never crossed my mind to put it into that book then. It just didn't. Dad was alive, it didn't. Yeah. But later on, and of course Joanna Mendelssohn outlined the affair quite elaborately. Not elaborately, but she devotes some attention to it in her book. And then once it was written, everybody seemed to be much more certain that it had occurred, which I really hadn't been up until that point. And of course it makes some sense. It's still a puzzling relationship, because and it is a pity in a way that they didn't talk about it, but you can see why people would choose not to, particularly when people are alive. But so I did feel I had to say something. I mean, I always feel a very faint twinge of guilt when I talk about it, because Mum didn't talk about it. So it's almost like a bit of daughterly betrayal. It's part of me always feels just this like one tenth of betrayal, because she didn't talk about it.
She chose not to.
And so it wasn't a thing. That's all. It's not that it shouldn't be talked about, but I just sort of feel it's one little bit of me feels, oh dear, I feel sorry that I have to, but there's no point in denying it or anything. It's just a slightly unknown element, I always feel. And I haven't devoted huge amounts of my time trying to plot and, you know, work out the exact details. I've tried to assess from the letters what went on. Quite clearly she did have a crush on him, I think.
Yes.
But there is no detail saying, like, we spent 3 hours kissing behind under the magnolias or something. I haven't come across that sort of detail anywhere. I should make that clear. So there's nothing... And it is just this rather playful thing where they called each other cats. I mean, they were obviously close, and it must have been really annoying for Rose, I can only imagine, to have had this sort of beautiful, fairly beautiful young woman getting close to her husband. Must have been annoying, to put it mildly, I would imagine.
Yes, I can imagine it was. I mean, she did, in Joanna Mendelssohn's books, there's a few sort of swipes that she seems to take.
Oh, yes, and there's meant to be drawings of Mum and Norman on a railway station, with Mum sort of large and Norman being little. It must have been infuriating, but the whole situation here to dive into, then you have to try and sort out what was the reality of the relationship between Norman and Rose. I don't think it's my place in time to work that out.
No.
Nor have I devoted a lot of energy, but they were all complex human beings, and human relationships don't fall neatly into place, particularly when you're dealing with free-spirited people. I've had friends who found difficulty archiving their own stuff because you don't want to be permanently plunged into the past. People usually just think, oh my God, I've got to do something with this stuff. And that's your first impulse, is to get it somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. And the letters between Norman and your mother also feature in Artful Cats.
Yes.
Which you edited. That was in 2001?
Yes.
Cats played a big part.
I don't know what it was about cats. They just loved them. And Mum used to feed stray cats outside her grandmother's house in Yass. And there was always a great story about that when one of her grandaunts, one was a retired teacher, I think perhaps they both were retired teachers, and one of them said to her, you know, we have to eat off those saucers, Margaret. So Mum picked up the saucer and smashed it against the wall and said, well, that's one saucer you won't have to eat off. Which refers to, I suppose, my mother, despite having quite a calm exterior, was also quite a feisty person. Mm-hmm. I talked about that to you off when we weren't recording earlier. But there was a spirit of independence in my mother, and I think the smashing of the saucer demonstrated that. And so when Norman and Mum first became involved, they did call each other puss. I mean, they referred to each other as dear puss. It was an intimate term they used for each other. But Mum also called me puss. I mean, she called Dad puss. It was what she would tend to call people. And she loved cats, and she used to take the zoo, take the ferry over to the zoo to look at the big cats there, and any sort of cat, anything feline, she liked.
Now, I just want to move on to a quite, well, related but different topic. In 2005, you wrote Margaret Olley's biography.
Yes.
Now, was she... how did that come about? Was she a contemporary of your mother's?
No, not really. Mum was older than Margaret Olley. It came about because Carol Davidson, who was a publisher at Random House, had read Autobiography of My Mother and loved the tone of that book. And Carol and Philip Bacon had been working together on having a biography of Margaret written. And Carol was very keen that I should write it because she wanted it to be, she loved the sort of tone of Autobiography of My Mother, and she really pushed for me. And then Philip and Margaret, who was also involved in the discussion, met me and agreed. I had to sort of go to afternoon tea with Margaret and pass a test, which I seemed to pass. And then it was agreed that I would do the book. But I approached it in the same way, but quite differently from Autobiography of My Mother. Autobiography of My Mother, as I've said earlier, was quite a spontaneous, anecdotal sort of book. But she hadn't read it cover to cover before it was published. And to sort of appease her for this, it was agreed that when we did the paperback edition that was always coming, she could make the changes in the paperback edition. And I did spend one rather agonising afternoon with her in Paddington when we went through the text. And instead of putting post-it notes in the book as a normal person might, she put dead matches between all the pages to mark where she wanted, not major changes, but sort of minor changes, which was all fair enough. Well, I guess it was a bit like going to Springwood, really. I mean, very different. But it was messy, you can't deny that. But I felt quite at home there. It was also really nice. It didn't worry me. I wouldn't like to live in that sort of way. But there was something very appealing about being there. And I sat opposite these French doors that opened onto the garden, and Margaret sat across the table from me. And the rest of it just sort of faded into a colourful jumble background, really. And I tried also not to try to take the whole house in at once. I thought it was better just to sort of get used to one bit of it at a time, so you weren't trying to sort of have the whole lot in your head. I am not a diary keeper, but when I was doing the bulk of the interviews, I did keep a diary every time I went there with an account of what had happened that day. And Margaret was very cooperative with the whole process. I used to do these telephone catch-up calls with her where I'd written a section and then questions would arise out, and I'd ring her up for a catch-up section with a whole list of questions that I had for her to answer. And she always made every effort to do that. She couldn't have been more cooperative during the writing process.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you lastly about what current projects you might be working on, if there's anything coming up.
I have been working on a sort of... Sometimes I say it's a deconstructed memoir. I have been putting together sort of episodes from my life and about other people who've been in my life, as a sort of, not my biography exactly, but it's sort of pieces of my life that flow on. And I had hoped to have that finished by the end of the year, but I haven't. And it might be finished by early next year. I don't know whether it's something that's going to be published, but I just feel I should press on and get it finished now. There's a piece that I wrote about my childhood impressions about Springwood, and that wasn't initially going to be part of it, but I've decided to make that part of it. It's strange, since we've begun talking about this and we're saying, when did my mother first come to Springwood? I mean, if my mum hadn't come here back when she was a young woman, when she's 20, there's no way I'd be sitting here talking to you today. I mean, it is Springwood and Norman that has resulted in me being here. Mm-hmm. Whatever happened, it was at this house in these grounds that whatever spark between Mum and Norman was first ignited. And without that happening, I don't think that Mum and Dad would have been involved. So I owe quite a lot to this house. As far as the house goes, the two areas I didn't perhaps mention was I said we sometimes went to the courtyard up here to the right from the kitchen, but both in the first, both when I first came here as a child and then as I came, when I came here as a teenager, often on a sunny afternoon, we would retreat to the courtyard there, mm-hmm. where there was a hammock, a sort of a striped canvas hammock on a, you know, a metal stand, and Mum and I would sit on that hammock in the sun, and Norman and Dad would be in sort of cane chairs, and we'd had afternoon tea out there, which would be tea and little cakes that Mum had either brought up from home or had made here after lunch. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. afternoon tea in the hammock. Mum and I would be almost asleep in the sun, but that was very much part of our visits, the afternoons there. He talks about in his memoir how he didn't know how he'd feel coming back to the house when it was set up, you know, had passed to the trust and become a gallery, but he said he feels it became, it was still a very happy place, and that's how he remembered it, and he felt that Norman would relish the sight of visitors coming here and gaining and enjoying the house. Mm.